Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine. And over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help. Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is episode 325. We're talking about how to train when you don't have a lot of time to do so. Now, we know that physical inactivity is a major health problem worldwide. It's the number four global risk factor for mortality, according to the World Health Organization, behind high blood pressure, tobacco use, and elevated blood sugar, of course. Now, time, or more specifically, a perceived lack of time, is one of the more common barriers to exercise. Now, there's active debate amongst experts as to whether or not the lack of time to exercise is responsible for the relatively low levels of physical activity globally, with some evidence suggesting other factors like low resources, low support, and low knowledge may be more causal. Still, most people will go through times where they feel like they don't have a lot of time to exercise. And in this episode, we'll discuss what happens when people stop exercising, how much exercise is really necessary, and how to program exercise when time is limited. On the other end of the line, we have the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, dude?
Hey, just got back from seeing you among some other friends in San Diego over the weekend, which was a good time, although complicated by a gastrointestinal illness that has knocked me back pretty hard for the past couple of days, but we're on the mend. So hoping to get back to normal soon.
Yeah, as is your custom, you decided to pass this on to me, although I can't say that this is a gastrointestinal sourced sort of issue. I have some sharp nagging right upper quadrant / right costal margin pain, and I assume it's your fault. I'm just blaming you on this.
I mean, shall we just pivot this into a mystery case podcast or what?
Yeah, 39-year-old male, previously healthy, presents with right unexplained costal margin pain. Yeah, it was the weirdest thing. I squatted yesterday 505 for a couple sets of five because, you know, fives and such. Mm-hmm. And I was fine doing that. And then afterwards, I'm like, you know when you feel like a little maybe like bloated, for example, and you have no real reason why, and you're like, well, I'll just go about my life and it'll go away. Yeah. It became like painful, and I was like, is this acute abdomen? Do I have like a ruptured pancreas or something, or like my gallbladder has exploded and now I've just you know? And then I was like, well, I don't have any constitutional signs, like I don't have a fever, I'm not nauseous, I don't have any other sort of stuff, so I guess it's probably just in my head or other what musculoskeletal or something, right? And it is a little bit better this morning, so I'm not, you might be off the hook is kind of what I'm getting at.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on things, see what happens.
Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of time being limited, I don't want to, you know, belabor the point here of what's going on in our lives. Let's talk about what happens and how to train when you don't have enough time. Now, most Americans, based on some survey data, it was actually pretty interesting how they did this, but that's for another podcast. Most Americans seem to have about 5 hours of free time per day, which I found fascinating because I was thinking in my own head, like, do I actually have 5 hours of free time per day? And then I looked at my Netflix history and I said, yes, I do, in fact, have about five hours per day of free time. Now, whether or not that's actually accounted for, or that's, you know, something that people can leverage effectively, that's a whole nother topic. But despite this seemingly overabundance of free time, you know, less than of 1/5 of people worldwide, adults worldwide, are actually meeting the current physical activity guidelines. Do you think that this sort of mismatch between maybe reported or even like experimentally determined free time and the amount of people you know, not hitting the current guidelines. What's the relationship there? Do you think this is more of a perception issue, or maybe there are other factors that are really, you know, limiting people's ability to exercise?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of what those 5 hours of quote unquote free time really consist of likely varies quite a bit between people. So even if, for example, that it represents 5 hours of time that is not spent doing like occupational duties for your job, there may be other things that you choose to spend that time on that are at least as important, or for some people maybe more important to them personally than engaging in exercise would be. So there may be some element of truth to that. But the other aspect of this is it reminds me of the studies in the nutrition world where they have people estimate their calorie intake and estimate their physical activity, you know, calorie expenditure, or like the amount of activity they do. And people just systematically and consistently, you know, underestimate how many calories they consume and overestimate how much energy they expend doing physical activity. And so I suspect that there's a huge portion of this that is more perception based. And almost like when you ask somebody on the spot, like, you know, why do you not engage in this amount of exercise, not in a judgmental way, but purely from like a scientific data gathering standpoint, humans are good at just confabulating explanations for things, just, you know, backfilling an explanation that sounds plausible to themselves, even if it's not necessarily perfectly accurate or fully explanatory.
Yeah. The other thing, and I think maybe more to your point, I don't know that all free time is like created equal, so to speak, right? If a good portion of that free time is really just time to unwind or otherwise, right, like, you know, sit in your thoughts, for example, like maybe that's not the best time to exercise. If it's commute based, is that really free time? Like, I don't know. And there's a bunch of other stuff that goes in there. Now, I think back historically with my own life, my own experience, when time was limited as far as exercise goes, most people would probably assume that like med school was one of those times. But by and large, that was not the case. And I understand that for most folks who have either gone through medical school or will be going to med school, that's probably not going to be their experience. Again, perceived or real, it is what it is. It just seemed like outside of third year, where your butt belongs to somebody else and you got to, you know, be somewhere at a certain time, go, you know, and everything else, I pretty much trained, you know, unopposed as long as I wanted to. In fact, I had to put some barriers in place so I wouldn't spend, you know, 3+ hours in the gym, because being at the gym, I wasn't studying. I wasn't, you know, and so I would almost prefer to do that than sit in front of the computer or sit in the library or whatever. Residency was a different story for sure. But a lot of that, again, was logistical, like, oh, I got to be in the hospital for 12 hours today. Plus, it's an hour commute each way. And then to the gym is another, you know, hour commute. That was LA. So I don't know. What do you think in your life, what were the most maybe time crunched periods as far as exercise goes? Can you think of some?
Yeah, it reflects similar situation. Out of medical school, you know, I would say that 80 to 85% of medical school was not a huge challenge to keep up with training. I think that it helped coming into school with like a good understanding of how I studied and study strategies and stuff to make that aspect of things relatively efficient. But first year, was able to train normally. Even second year, when the academic load really ramps up, was still able to train pretty normally. I would say a fraction of third year on the quote unquote easier rotations was able to keep training pretty normally. The low point during that time was my general surgery rotation, which was extremely demanding and difficult to maintain my normal training. It was heavily modified and abbreviated for that month or two of school. But otherwise, yeah, school, agree, not terribly disruptive. But residency was, I would say, more disruptive, but still just extremely variable. You know, our typical schedule would be, you know, you'd spend 4 weeks doing a particular rotation, which could be an inpatient rotation in the hospital, it could be an outpatient rotation, it could be an ICU, some other sort of elective thing. And those all have such variable schedules that on an ICU month, it could be a lot more challenging. But at the same time, I did a lot of ICU months where I did a 28-hour shift every third day. And so there was 28 hours, like Monday at 7 a.m. until, you know, Tuesday at 11 a.m. when I was not able to train because I was in the unit. I'd go home, I'd get some sleep, I'd train, and then I'd have the next day off. I'd train that day, and then I'd go in and do it again. So I was able to even train relatively consistently just during the periods when I wasn't at the hospital during those months. But and then night, you know, working nights for 2 months or whatever the case is. So it just required a bit of flexibility. But I would say that the surgical, you know, the more demanding rotations as a third year medical student, and then the more demanding schedule-wise, you know, parts of residency were definitely the hardest parts to maintain, at least this the type of training schedule that I would otherwise self-select for myself.
Yeah. Now, granted, you and I both had many things going in our favor with respect to like exercising to the level that we wanted to. One, we both had gyms in our domiciles, especially in medical school. And then you in residency, I actually had to travel to a gym in residency. Also, we knew how to train. Like we're very familiar with how to exercise, right? Yeah. And it was already part of our lifestyle. So like continuing it, I think is much easier than like starting it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd actually be really interested in like a quality improvement project for future healthcare providers. Like what if, you know, as part of like JCO's, you know, sort of quality standard that every either hospital system or university-based hospital system had a full gym. You had to have a full gym
on campus
in the hospital. Yeah. And then some protected time for learners and practitioners to exercise. Whether or not everyone takes advantage of that, hey, that's a whole nother like enforcement thing, like that another podcast perhaps. But I do wonder, I'm like, look, what if we made this more accessible? So we eliminate that and we have some protected time to use it, kind of like you have protected study time. Like you would theoretically predict that healthcare providers would exercise more, so good for them, just to their own health, but then also because they'd be more familiar with not only the benefits of exercise, but also like how to get it in and how it improves their own quality of life, they would likely, you know, based on existing evidence, counsel more patients and feel more confident in doing so because they have personal experience with it. So that would be like my maybe a quality improvement project. Again, if you're a medical student or you're resident, you're looking for a quality improvement project. There you go. Do you think that's true? Do you think that would work? Or do you think that's more just speculative? And I'm talking at my rear end.
Yeah, I think that's a solid dose of speculation that I would like to be true. But general, less optimistic. I think that compared to not doing this, some fraction of people might, you know, take you up on it. It might move the needle a little bit. I think we would ultimately feel, relatively speaking, underwhelmed by something like this. You know, I think about all the other demands that are put on the time of a physician in practice or a physician in residency. You know, they will often lament like doing quote unquote like mandatory wellness modules and click through internet trainings and things like that, you know, are maybe well intended but ultimately ineffectual for all sorts of reasons. And so this is something that you would just have to see, you know, generate something with some good external validity and just see what happens. But yeah, that's my sense that physicians are humans too, and humans are you know, we have a strong bias to not do these kind of things even when they're made available to us.
Yeah, especially if told to do so, if it's mandatory, for sure. All right, well, let's get into this podcast. The first thing I want to start with is just sort of this overall paradigm, because we're going to be talking a lot about programming. So if you're unfamiliar with exercise programming, exercise prescription, I want to make sure that everybody's on the same page with kind of the model that we're using to sort of predict how people would respond to exercise, or in some cases, the lack of exercise. And so the model that we use here is called the fitness fatigue model, wherein an exercise program that contains things like the exercise selection, rest periods, loading, volume, how close these efforts are taken to failure, how often people exercise, and so on, all of these exercise prescription factors, we collectively refer to that as the training stimulus. So all of the nuts and bolts of a particular program, we call that the training stimulus. The person does that, or it's imposed upon them in my sort of quality improvement project. And then they experience the exercise program as training stress. Okay. And so the people will respond very differently to a given sort of exercise intervention based on their current levels of fitness, their genetics, their expectations, their mood, nutritional status, sleep status, all of the things that make the individual a unique biological organism. And so that experienced sort of training stress then leads to both fitness and fatigue at the same time. Not necessarily in the same amounts. You could have a very well-programmed exercise intervention that leads to more fitness relative to fatigue. You could have a very poorly planned exercise intervention that leads to more fatigue than fitness adaptations. And so assuming intelligent exercise programming, we would like to generate as many fitness adaptations as possible with the given amount of resources, which includes time. And so what we're trying to solve for here is, what is the maximum dose of training stimulus that a person can tolerate, not only logistically, so time that they have available to them. And also, you know, is there a gym nearby, all sorts of stuff. And also what they can tolerate physiologically, meaning that if somebody like you or I, Austin, who are well-trained, well, we can certainly tolerate a much higher level of exercise than somebody who's previously inactive. So that's the thing we're trying to solve for. What is the maximum dose of training stimulus that can be tolerated not only logistically, but also physiologically? And again, we assume intelligent programming. So that's, again, appropriate selection of exercise, loading, rest periods, rep schemes, proximity to failure, et cetera, relative to an individual's goals and their current level of fitness. Hopefully, it's at least, this dose is at least maintenance level training stress for very well-trained individuals and the minimum effective dose for untrained individuals. And in a perfect world, there's extra room logistically to get close to that physiological barrier, meaning that, we want at least maintenance level, right? Or at least a small enough amount of exercise that can be performed to improve health adaptations and fitness adaptations. But hopefully there's a little bit more so we can get closer to fully realizing somebody's physical development. Does that kind of make sense with how you think about this issue?
Yeah, it does. And as far as this might represent an introduction for somebody, maybe somebody just got sent this like podcast of, hey, you know, training with little time. If you want to distill this down, just any particular, you know, exercise session that you might do is going to contribute in some way positively towards your development. And it's going to come at a cost of, you know, fatiguing you a bit and or potentially a lot, depending on what exactly you do. And the aim of programming, especially over the, you know, over the short term, over the medium term, and definitely over the long term, is trying to balance those two as favorably as possible to get you the most bang for your buck, not necessarily with like no fatigue, because it's always going to be, you know, some part of it, but trying to generate a favorable trade-off between how much of the positive benefits we get you without wrecking you too bad or beating you up too badly in the course of it.
Yeah, any exercise that actually has the potential to improve health and or fitness adaptations is going to be fatiguing on some level. The relative amount of fatigue that's generated, that's more specific to the program, the programming approach. And yeah, there are good and bad examples of that all over the internet. And certainly, that's not a new problem. I suppose the best way to lead into this is maybe considering the alternative to what to do when time is limited. The alternative, of course, would be to not exercise. And so, you know, that is obviously a choice that many people are making if we believe in free will and sort of humans being autonomous functioning beings. And so if you don't exercise, what happens then? We've covered this previously on a podcast, you know, what happens when you stop lifting, for example. And so this is going to be a brief review of that. I'll link the full podcast to that in the show notes. But it really sort of matters how you get to a point of not exercising, right? Because they're not all the same. You could have a person with a severe illness, for example, or injury, or being immobilized, right? Secondary to a fracture or some other sort of a condition where they need to be in bed rest. And that is far different than somebody who's otherwise healthy, otherwise moving, you know, occupationally or another like recreational non-exercise activities. Those are disparate sort of groups, totally different. And so we're just going to focus on that latter group, somebody who's otherwise healthy, who was previously exercising normally, but isn't now due to time crunch. So the general heuristic here, general rule, general concept is that there's a dose-dependent relationship between the duration of inactivity and loss of fitness adaptations. I'll say that again. There's a dose-dependent relationship between the duration of insufficient exercise and the loss of fitness adaptations. And to an additional point, health adaptations. If somebody was using exercise, for example, to help control their blood sugar or their resting blood pressure or something like that, and they stop exercising, yeah, health markers would also tend to trend back towards perhaps an unhealthy level. In this specific context, strength losses seem to outpace changes in muscle size, so decreases in muscle size, which both seem to take longer to decline compared to VO2 max, which is a measure of cardiorespiratory fitness. And that's where we'll start this little journey here with what would happen if you just decided, again, decided in air quotes, to not exercise during periods where time is limited. So with respect to cardiorespiratory fitness as measured by VO2 max, in previously untrained adults who trained for 13 weeks, their average VO2 max increased decreased significantly. Then the subjects either continued to exercise or stopped exercising for 4 weeks. And so the researchers could basically see, well, look, how quickly, if at all, did their VO2 max decay? And in 4 weeks, the group that stopped exercising, their VO2 maxes returned to basically pre-intervention levels, effectively the same as when they were not exercising at all. So a pretty quick turnaround from the gains that they saw. And interestingly, there's a kind of this dose-dependent relationship between cardiorespiratory fitness and reductions in cardiovascular disease risk, right? And so if during this exercise period, their risk of heart disease went down significantly, which it did because their VO2 max improved, well, after 4 weeks of detraining, it was effectively back to what it was when they weren't exercising. So you kind of have to keep going, and which I am sure I'm sure is a surprise to absolutely no one. You got to like, you can't just exercise for a few years of your life and expect that those benefits to be lifelong. Although there are some persistent adaptations we would expect, and we'll talk about that here shortly. But that's in untrained individuals, so people who previously weren't active. What about in like more highly trained individuals? So another study of 15 highly trained endurance athletes across a bunch of different endurance-based sports, they basically stopped their exercise programs for 2 weeks, and their VO2 max went down by 4%, which is about twice the sort of minimum detectable difference in VO2 max testing. It's about 1.5 to 1.8%. So you're just, you know, about twice that much, which is not nothing, to be clear. Whether or not that represents a significant decline that would cause a performance decrease, it's more complicated than that in endurance sports than just a VO2 max level. However, we would expect, if we had to just predict somebody's performance based on nothing else other than VO2 max level, we'd say, well, yeah, 2 weeks of not training prior to like a test of your endurance performance would probably result in a decreased performance. To me, though, overall, it just seems that cardiorespiratory fitness is very plastic, and in that it responds readily to either the presence of exercise or the absence of exercise. And so, again, no surprise that no exercise is going to cause this to decline in relatively short order.
Yeah, I think that that is reflective of a lot of folks' experience. You know, as a former endurance athlete and who swam with a lot of other folks who would come into the competitive season maybe not having done a ton over the summer, and then, you know, getting whipped into shape by our coach over the first, you know, couple weeks to month or two of the season. I don't think that you would necessarily see somebody who was as detrained from a strength standpoint, getting whipped back into like peak strength performance over the course of, you know, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, something like that, just because of the nature of that time course of adaptation and the amount of work that it takes to get there compared with what's tolerable. There is a ton of overlap here. There's a ton of fuzziness. You know, some people are going to be kind of more favorably wired up for one type of adaptation, aerobic-wise or strength-wise, and so there's certainly going to be outliers there. But yeah, I mean, that the body adapts to, you know, stimulus or the lack of stimulus is consistent with everything we know about, you know, living biology.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so moving on to strength, which again is the force production measured in a specific context. So there are different types of strength. Typically what we see here, again, is an asymmetrical sort of reduction in strength and size that is proportional to how long people aren't exercising for. So the longer people aren't exercising for, the greater the loss of strength and size, with strength typically outpacing muscle size in this particular group of individuals who are not injured, not immobilized, and not otherwise critically ill. So they just basically said, I'm not going to exercise for a little bit, whether it's due to a study design like we'll discuss here or due to some like time crunch. That's the main topic of this podcast. So just a brief review of some of the literature on this. In a group of previously untrained adolescents who lifted weights for 3 months and who increased their back squat one rep max by an average of 20 kilograms, that's 44 pounds, 3 weeks of training cessation, of detraining, did not significantly reduce muscle size or strength. So, hey, 3 weeks, took off the gym, they were fine. Okay. And in strength athletes, so these were powerlifters and Division I college football players who had an average one rep max bench press of 330 pounds and an average 1RM squat of 462 pounds, they showed virtually no significant strength or size loss after 2 weeks of training. And so just collectively taking those two studies, My general thought here is that short periods of detraining or lack of training probably don't have a big impact on strength and size, which is reflected in the literature. Similarly, we covered this on our November research review. You had previously untrained adults who trained for 10 weeks and they did 10 weeks of detraining. Well, the strength loss in the 10 weeks of detraining was only 5% from peak, but still well above baseline. So it's not that people wouldn't lose any strength as time goes on, but it's not all of it. Can you imagine how long you would have to stop training for your squat to go back to where it was when you first started exercising? How long do you think that would take?
Yeah. Yeah. I can only, the only way I can conjure something like that is by some sort of horrible debilitating disease. Otherwise, I think it would take, decades.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and in general, the longer period of training cessation or detraining produces greater declines in strength performance of strength trained individuals. Overall, the loss is limited to about 10% during periods of inactivity ranging from 2 to 3 months. And then when data is available, strength is still above baseline during these periods of detraining. When it goes on for longer than that, though, there's an apparent dose-dependent relationship with time and strength loss. So the longer the training cessation, the greater amount of strength loss. And there are other studies I covered in the previous podcast on what happens when you stop lifting weights. But when we're talking about like many months or potentially years of detraining, yeah, we would expect further decline. But whether or not people get back to baseline, that is more a question of how strong they were before they stopped training. So in folks who previously were not exercising, for example, but who trained for 6 months, it looks like about the same amount of time of detraining, maybe 6 months, 8 months or whatever, they're going to go back to their base pre-exercise levels of strength. But a person like you, Dr. Baraki, or me, or somebody else who's relatively well-trained, it might take the rest of our lives to actually get back. I'm trying to think of my very first squat session. I remember I had just gotten cleared to exercise from a dislocated hip, and I had never seen anybody squat in the gym with less than a big plate on each side, a 45-pound plate. So I didn't think you could actually squat the empty ball. Like, I didn't know that that was the thing. So I just put the 45s on there and I went down to the bottom and I fell over. I couldn't lift it back up. So if my baseline squat, we'll call it 135, like how long would it take me to get back there? I suspect I suspect the rest of my life, provided I have no like orthopedic issue that would prevent me from squatting or otherwise like neural disease where I couldn't actually recruit my muscles. I'm pretty sure I can squat that for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I think that's likely in the absence of some sort of medical condition that would accelerate, muscle loss or strength loss or something like that. My own experience, I don't actually know what my first squat was like ever. My kind of starting time point was actually after I finished college swimming. And we did a little bit of lifting alongside our swimming. And back then, I think my heaviest like one rep max squat was maybe around like 220 pounds or something like that. Like high bar to parallel. But my first like dedicated like strength training session after I started lifting after swimming, I think I squatted somewhere around 150 pounds for, a set of five. And so that was after emerging from, collegiate swimming training and stuff like that. And so, yeah, similarly for me to get back to where 150 pounds was like a hard set for me, many, many, many years, I would expect in the absence of something else that would accelerate the loss.
Yeah, we'll maybe we'll release a new template called linear regression where you just take weight off the bar every week until you're back at baseline, see what happens. Okay, so overall, it's hard to say how long strength adaptations will be maintained without exercise. We would predict relatively little loss of strength in the short term, such as a few weeks to a few months. And the rate of decay will vary by individual, generally increasing as the period of detraining increases. All right, so let's move on to size here, so muscle size. As mentioned before, the loss in strength appears to outpace the loss in size during periods of detraining, particularly in those who were previously untrained but who gained muscle size during the training period. So for example, a group of women who had previously strength trained for 20 weeks and then detrained for 30 to 32 weeks had relatively little change in muscle cross-sectional area during the period of detraining. Another study trained four groups of people, young men and young women ages 20 to 30, and older men and women ages 65 to 75 for 9 weeks, followed by a 31-week detraining period. During the training period, muscle cross-sectional area, so that's muscle size, increased significantly in all groups, whereas the detraining loss was much smaller by comparison in all groups except for the older women, whose muscle mass was similar to baseline levels after detraining. And a recent meta-analysis on older adults who were previously untrained and then lifted weights regularly for periods of 2 to 6 months and then stopped, well, muscle size loss wasn't significant until about 6 months later, despite losing strength after a month of detraining. And so this is representative of previously untrained individuals prior to the study intervention. In general, once they stop exercising, muscle size doesn't seem to change that much, but muscle strength can, whether that's neuromuscular related adaptations or just the preservation of muscle tissue because that's so important for function, unclear, and much less is known about trained individuals. Like if you're a competitive bodybuilder, competitive natural bodybuilder, for example, or other other person who is interested in gaining a bunch of muscle mass, and then you stopped lifting, we don't really know like how long it would take you to get to your sort of baseline or pre-exercise level of muscle mass. Again, Austin, if you had to predict how long it would take for you to go back to 150-pound Austin, how long do you think that would take you?
Yeah, I think the other variable to consider here is that there's going to be a lot, potentially more of a nutritional impact in terms of your energy balance and such, that if I maintained a similar energy, you know, intake as what I would take in now, a whole lot longer. I think that in the absence of any training, my appetite does generally tend to drift downward. And so I do tend to spontaneously lose weight when I'm not, you know, sufficiently active. And so I actually think that it's interesting to think about what the potential variability is in these kind of study populations across multiple variables, like one of which including like people who are more anabolically sensitive versus more anabolically resistant. There's going to be differences in their trajectory in the aftermath, right? There's going to be this the people who have identified themselves as being like, you know, especially muscular and athletic, like immediately post puberty, for example, those are going to be your more, you know, typically anabolically sensitive folks who are going to hang on to more muscle mass across their lifespan. And they're going to be the prototypical, like, you know, dad strength kind of folks who just have a crushing grip, even when they're like 60 years old. Whereas others who are more anabolically resistant are going to drift downward much more readily or quickly in the absence of sufficient stimulus. So yeah, I think I would probably hang on to strength maybe a little bit longer than I would mass, just because of the impacts on my appetite as a unique situation.
Yeah, definitely nutrition inputs, but also like occupational inputs. You can imagine people who have a very like physically strenuous job, maybe there's a signal to like preserve more muscle mass in the absence of formalized training versus somebody who, I don't know, previously worked as a laborer and now is working at a desk and is also now not exercising. On top of that, you're like, maybe more rapid sort of atrophy. But again, the general concept here is that the human body is very plastic. And I don't mean that in a sense of way of like microplastics or, you know, nanoparticles or anything like that. It just means that we readily adapt to whatever our environment is. And so if that environment includes a lot of exercise, we respond to that. And if there's an absence of exercise, well, we respond to that too, perhaps not in the ways that we want. So when time is limited, how do we go about programming? All right, we're here on episode 325 with Dr. Austin Baraki on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. When we think about the sort of amount of exercise that we want most people to get, whether they have a limited amount of time or an extensive amount of time, I think there's a sort of systematic way we can go about this. And the place I would start are the current physical activity guidelines. Now, these guidelines came out in 2018, and we've talked about them, I don't know, what do you think, Austin, about 1,000 times on this podcast now? I mean, I know we don't have 1,000 episodes, but I've definitely said physical activity guidelines at least 1,000 times on our podcast series. So as they currently sit, they recommend twice weekly resistance training, moderate or greater intensity involving all major muscle groups on two or more days of the week. And they specify 1 to 3 sets of 8 to 12 repetitions of each exercise as a general recommendation. They also recommend at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity conditioning, or you can do 75 minutes of vigorous intensity conditioning or some combination thereof to achieve 500 to 1,000 met minutes per week of conditioning. Again, that's of conditioning, so you don't count your resistance training towards that. So that's kind of the baseline that we want everybody to shoot for, okay? So if somebody can get that in with their given amount of time in a week, great. They're checking the exercise box. We are very happy. But what about if it's less than that, or if the person is more trained than somebody who previously wasn't exercising? Maybe there's some nuance here. So if somebody has less time to train, they can't currently meet the guidelines, that would sort of enter this arena of minimal dose or minimum exercise dose. And so this is defined as exercise that does not meet the guidelines recommended by professional organizations, but still has the potential to improve health as well as muscle strength, size, and cardiorespiratory fitness, which actually sent me down a rabbit hole of just thinking about this. Like, is there an amount of exercise that is so small that actually does not have the potential to improve health by any metric that we can currently test for? And I started thinking about it. I was like, I don't think so. There are studies that look at like 15 seconds of like a high intensity sprint on a wind gate and look at what it does to blood sugar. Look at what it does to resting blood pressure for this period of time. So I'm like, is there something that's actually too short? Shout out to Too Short, you know, great guy. Is there something that's either too short or too low of an intensity that, but still counts as exercise that doesn't have the potential to improve health? Can you think of something like that?
Yeah, I think the only way that I can come up with something like that is by contrasting the stimulus against the person's existing capacity, right? So if somebody is like very, very fit, then maybe doing a 15-second effort is no longer enough of a stimulus to drive any further adaptation for them. But for completely untrained people, I mean, you can do isometrics and get, you know, improvements, you know, from that kind of situation. I think about like the patients that I see in the hospital who are like frail and debilitated. And it's like, if I can get you to like lift your leg up off the bed, you're probably going to experience some improvement from that. If just like having you sit up in a chair and holding your trunk up to eat your meals instead of lying flat in bed for your meals, that's something else that represents a stimulus to you. So it's really just the stimulus matched to the person, but the less trained they are, then yeah, essentially any like muscle contraction, isometric, eccentric, concentric, you know, I wonder if like you could even do like guided motor imagery and have them just like close their eyes and mentally imagine contracting their muscle really hard. I bet that there would be some neurologically mediated improvement in like force production potential from something like that.
Yeah, there's actually a study looking at like practicing the test. It was a leg press 1RM or whatever, and people were they were shown video of this, right? Versus a group who was not shown a video of how to do a 1RM leg press, and the people actually improved.
Yeah, with visualization works, you know. So I'm not surprised.
And practicing the test itself, there's like this period of acclimation that happens where people actually can improve their leg press 1RM, for example. In this one series, one study I'm thinking of, it happened 11 days in a row. They were able to increase their leg press 1RM consecutively just by practicing the test. And so it's, yeah, there's some, it'd be really hard to come up with a scenario where fitness is not going to improve by something that is legitimately exercise, even if it's a low amount. And so, yeah, we have data showing, you know, 1 to 2 days a week of exercise, a very small amounts of exercise can reduce mortality risk, can reduce risk of cardiovascular disease. There's even data on single set resistance training that's been going on. That debate has been going on in exercise science since, you know, the 70s and 80s, where, oh, you can do just one set to failure and that'll get you, you know, a large amount of results from muscular hypertrophy and muscle strength. We have data on that. There's data on exercise snacks. So these isolated 1 minute bouts of vigorous activity exercise performed periodically throughout the day. Well, that can increase strength, can increase improve function, can decrease pain sensitivity. Although again, most of the data in these exercise snacks is limited to older individuals. But the general thing here is that any exercise is better than nothing, especially for untrained individuals. But in trained individuals, you're probably going to need a higher amount of minimum dose of exercise to get any sort of improvement. And maybe one of the better studies on this came out recently in 2021. This was on powerlifters, so competitive powerlifters. They looked at what was the minimum dose that was required to see an improvement in one rep max strength in this particular group. And they found that 3 to 6 weekly sets of squat, bench, and deadlift using 1 to 5 reps and weights greater than 80% of 1RM can improve strength in this population. Now, that wouldn't improve my 1RM performance. If so, I would be much stronger by now. Yeah, but right. But in this particular group, that's what they found. And so to me, that represents maybe a floor level of like training stress that would be needed for a strength trained athlete to accomplish per week. But I also don't think that would be used in perpetuity. Like, oh, you could just do this forever and keep getting stronger. Maybe for a short period of time, maybe in particularly sensitive individuals who just, you know, are hyper responders to exercise in general, that may work. But I don't think that's like a long-term strategy.
Yeah, fully agree. I think that should be intuitive to most people that like a floor minimum dose is not ever going to be a long-term strategy if the goal is to do your best to try to continue to improve performance over the long term. If either of us were thrust into a situation where we were extremely limited on time, I think that we would probably gravitate towards a strategy like this where we'd want to maintain some regular exposure to like pretty heavy weights. Not to say we'd be taking our sets, you know, all to failure necessarily, but some exposure to maintain like the strength skill, and then whatever additional volume we're able to squeeze in during the time we have available would be how we would fill in the rest.
Yeah. So let's wrap up this concept here of like kind of what we're trying to achieve here from an exercise dosing standpoint. So first, we're trying to achieve just anything. Like literally any form of exercise is going to be better than none. So like that's ground level. First, let's do something. The next, the sort of second benchmark or milestone that we'd like people to reach is meeting the current physical activity guidelines, both the resistance training and the conditioning part. After that, now we're playing with house money. So we're basically trying to figure out what is the maximum amount of exercise that a person can tolerate, both logistically and physiologically, because that is likely to drive the maximum improvement in both health and fitness adaptations. And again, that's if we're trying to get the most out of our time spent exercising and we have this time available to do so, that's what we're shooting for. So generally speaking, again, this is broad strokes, and that should clue you in as to why these ranges are so wide. For untrained individuals, we're looking at like 1 to 4 sets per exercise for each major muscle group, performed 2 to 3 times per week for 6 to 10 reps per set at a one rep at an intensity that's greater than 65% of their one rep max, using 2 minute or longer rest periods, and getting at least 150 minutes per week of conditioning done. That's for untrained individuals. That's a general recommendation of like how much exercise to do. For trained individuals, this varies based on the individual's fitness, their goals, and so on. But generally, it's going to be more than that. How much more? I cannot say. But when I look at this, that sort of untrained individual's exercise prescription level, I'm thinking, oh, well, if I just doubled that, that would be about right, maybe for me, or a good place to start. Anyway, does that kind of make sense to you?
Yeah, I think that, you know, by the time you get much more trained, you start to have a lot more personal kind of experience off which to base your decisions by recognizing retrospectively, what have I done well with before? What have I not done so well with before? Where are my preferences kind of oriented and what am I trying to achieve? If I, you know, during periods where I was trying to maximize my aerobic capacity for competitive swimming, yeah, I was in the pool 9 times a week and lifting, you know, only twice a week. And then during times when I was trying to maximize my strength training performance, I was in the gym, you know, lifting 6 times a week. I think for some periods of time, I would even add in a 7 session during like bench every day periods and things like that. And I was maybe doing some conditioning once a week during some of those periods, just compromises in either direction. So that's just examples of how that varied based on my, you know, goals at any given time.
Yeah. And you think about like highly trained endurance athletes, you know, they're doing 9, 10, 15, 20 hours of conditioning per week, right? And you're like, wow, that's a lot. You're like, well, if you want the highest level of performance, it's not going to be accomplished with the minimum dose, right. But you can still get something out of a little bit. And that's kind of what we're talking about here. Okay. So with that sort of heuristic in mind, anything's better than nothing, then try to hit the guidelines. And then after that, if you still have more time left over, try to do the most that you can that will actually generate improvements in fitness and health. How do we actually program that? And so I take you back to the acronym that I created. And I did also, I tried to think of a better acronym for exercise prescription. I think we're stuck with water. I'm going to have to come up with some different terms. But the acronym we're using here is WATER, which stands for weight, so the intensity, amount, volume. T stands for the type, so the modality and exercise selection. And then ER stands for effort and regulation. So just generally speaking, when we think about the weight or the intensity, that's the W in water. We're looking for most of your resistance training elements should be performed at greater than 65% of your 1RM. Why greater than 65%? Well, it's shown that at intensities at that level or above, strength improvements are greater than when the intensity levels are lower than that. Yes, there's some fudge and fuzziness around that particular number, but I think that's generally a good heuristic for folks to follow. If somebody was like a powerlifter who had a limited amount of time to train and they had a powerlifting meet upcoming, you could make a case for doing some single rep efforts in there too at a much higher intensity, whether it's 80, 8% to 93%. That's a reasonable range. But when I think about limited time ability to like train, limited time to train, singles are out the window for me. And the reason why is because, okay, I already know that this period of time is a compromise for me as far as like training goals and like maybe life goals or life situation. But the other part is that warming up. Hey everyone, I hope that you're enjoying the podcast. Just wanted to remind you that we have launched our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, Plus members get early access to our podcast, ad-free listening, written transcripts and summaries, videos, exclusive access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. And just think, no more of these ads. Thanks for your support. Now back to the podcast. This podcast is sponsored by MasterClass. For a gift that's always on time and lasts a lifetime, you can't do better than MasterClass. With MasterClass, you can learn from the best to become your best. You guys are wondering who my dream mentor is? It's probably Neil deGrasse Tyson for scientific communication or Mark Cuban on business. And I was really excited when I heard that they both have classes on MasterClass. MasterClass is the only streaming platform where you can learn and grow with over 200 of the world's top experts. And this holiday season, don't just give your loved ones something that they want, give them something that they want to be. With MasterClass, they can finally become a better cook, writer, entrepreneur, or an artist like they've always wanted. Whatever you choose, it's hard to go wrong with MasterClass. Plus, there's no risk. Every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Give your loved ones a year of learning with MasterClass. Now, MasterClass always has great offers during the holidays, sometimes as much as up to 50% off. You can head over to masterclass.com/BBM for their current offer. That's up to 50% off at masterclass.com/BBM. That's masterclass.com/BBM. This podcast is sponsored by Factor. While we all know that nutrition is huge when it comes to health and performance, we don't always have time to shop for and prepare healthy meals. The days are getting shorter, but your to-do lists aren't. So instead of reaching for your phone to order out or heading to the nearest restaurant, let Factor help you take the stress out of healthy eating this winter. You can skip the grocery stores, the prep work, cooking fatigue, etc., and instead get chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to your door. Factor lets you choose from a ton of different meal plans, including everything from vegan to high-protein options and everything in between. They've got guilt-free comfort foods like homestyle chicken and gravy and loaded mashed potato pork chops, feel-good vegan options like sweet potato and chickpea curry, and gourmet plus dishes like truffle butter filet mignon. When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. You can change up your order every week. You could pause or reschedule whenever you want. And check this out, Factor is cheaper than takeout, and that's definitely important heading into this holiday season. Now, if you want a helping hand with your nutrition, head over to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off. This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up. And according to the 2022 Annual Data Breach Report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the U.S. in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni.
To an actually challenging single is so time consuming for me, just given my strength sort of training history. It's not worth the, 20 minutes or so it actually takes to warm up for that if I'm actually trying. I could warm up to a single in maybe 5 minutes, 8 minutes or whatever, but how useful that would be is maybe more up for debate.
Yeah, I think it is up for debate. I have a very well-known YouTube video of warming up to some pretty heavy singles in, anywhere in like the 3 to 8 minute range. And, it was not necessarily the equivalent to the load that I would have been able to reach had I had all the time in the world to warm up to it.
But I think that depending on the types of adaptations that you are prioritizing, if you're like, you know, I'm a competitive lifter and I want to try to maintain this skill component, you know, for whatever reason that is a priority for you, you can get a lot, even if the top single that you're getting to is 5%, maybe even 10% off of what you would otherwise hit. If you're getting up to that in relatively short order and you are volitionally trying to move that weight as quickly as you can for that single, you could probably, you know, train yourself to get up to do that kind of warm up pretty quickly. And then, you know, let's say, for example, we'll obviously get to this, but I could envision a scenario where, for example, I worked up to a top single really quickly and then stripped down the weight and I did like two back off sets closer to failure on the back offs or something, and then called that good for the day. That would be a not unreasonable kind of approach in this kind of a situation.
Yeah, I definitely think it's viable. I think where I fall on that is that I would maybe prefer the multi-rep sets to take more precedent, and I would just do those first. And if I really wanted to do a single, I would do it after that, just as like, okay, skill practice.
Yeah.
And again, we're just making this up. And when I say making this up, it means that it doesn't mean that we're not aware of the evidence or whatever. It's just that there are limitations in the evidence as far as like the granularity in prescription. So it's more about kind of preferences and how this works in somebody's schedule and so on. So yeah, in general though, for most of your resistance training should be done at a intensity that's greater than 65% of the 1RM, particularly for strength. For hypertrophy, there's a much wider range of loading that would work. So as low as like 30% of your 1RM max, all the way up to much heavier stuff, as long as it gets close-ish to failure. So within 4 to 5 reps of failure, it's going to work for hypertrophy. So much wider range of intensities that are viable. And then for conditioning, we're looking at something that's at least about 60% of your maximum heart rate. And one of the hardest things to quantify in exercise science is like, what actually counts as exercise? You know, like, where's the floor for cardiorespiratory, for conditioning exercise? Is it 50% of your max heart rate? Is it 60%? Is it 50% of your VO2 peak, for example? And there's definitely some controversy here, but I think suggesting about 60% of your heart rate max is a reasonable recommendation, understanding that there's some squish around that for as like, what's the minimum thing that counts as exercise. So does gardening count as exercise from a conditioning standpoint? I suspect not, unless it's like very vigorous gardening at a sustained effort. You know, the problem really there is like, oh, you do some digging, you plant something, you water, whatever, and maybe that does, you know, increase your heart rate due to energy demands and oxygen demands to those tissues. But for how long? Right. And it's like, I don't know that that actually counts. It's better than not being active, to be clear. But as far as the comparison to like, oh, you're on a treadmill, you're on a bike, you're on an erg or whatever, probably not as much benefit from a cardiorespiratory fitness development standpoint. All right. So that's the W. That's weight and intensity. 65% or so for strength, much wider range for hypertrophy, and probably about 60% of your heart rate max for conditioning efforts. That's the sort of floor there. As far as the amount, that's the A in our WATER acronym of exercise prescription. This refers to amount or the volume. I think it's reasonable to recommend at least 3 to 5 sets per week per muscle group, as far as a sort of floor of like, look, how much resistance training do you need to really do in order to generate some sort of fitness and health related adaptations? I suspect there is a very vulnerable, very adaptable group out there that could get away with like 1 set per muscle group per week. But I suspect that sort of improvement is going to peter out relatively quickly at 1 set per week. And so, yeah, I think if we're thinking about a 4-week, 8-week, 12-week sort of training intervention where time is limited or longer, certainly I'm thinking a little bit higher recommendation is reasonable. So that's why 3 to 5 sets per week per muscle group is probably the low end of what I would probably want to see somebody do. And then for more trained individuals or folks with more time, I think a more aggressive sort of recommendation would be 10 to 15 sets per week if you can get that much in. For me, I counted how many squat pattern sets I had last week, and I was at 27. So that's not a flex. Like, there are people out there doing far more than that, and there are people who are much stronger than me doing less than that. So that's just what I did last week. But just as a comparison, as sort of like what I'd be thinking about in a time crunch setting versus like unlimited time, it's about half really of what I'm currently doing. Does that kind of jibe with your experience?
Yeah, I think my highest periods of training volume for myself probably had a bit less, you know, working sets than what you expose yourself to, at least these days. And that was just kind of what I gravitated to in terms of what was necessary for me. at that period of time. There's also going to be some trade-off in terms of the number of sets that somebody might need to progress outside of just individual factors, but how close they're taking them to failure. You know, if somebody's pulling like one all-out set of deadlifts to failure, they can probably do that once a week. Of course, how much progress that's going to lead to and for how long, as you alluded, might not be for very long necessarily. But if the goal is not necessarily progress, but maintenance during a period of severe time crunch, then, you know, I would totally take like one real hard set a week of something. You could probably maintain quite a lot of strength for a long time in that on average in people.
Yeah. One hard set per week, fine. That's certainly better than nothing.
Yeah.
But then if you got to choose, you'd be like, maybe a little bit more than that. And then you would keep going down that road until you ran out of time. That's again, general heuristic. And then lastly, on amount, as far as conditioning goes, I'd at least like to see folks getting 150 minutes per week of conditioning exercise, so cardio activity. If somebody said, look, that's a non-starter for me right off the jump. I do not have an extra, 2.5 hours per week just to do on conditioning plus lifting weights. Come on, guys. What are you talking about? Then I sort of pivot to, all right, well, the volume load recommendation, which basically is a mixture of intensity and volume, or the amount of exercise people are doing, is 500 met minutes per week, where higher intensity conditioning efforts cost you more mets per minute. So sprinting, for example, or running quickly, for example, that might be like a 10 met activity per minute. All right. Whereas jogging, at a relatively moderate pace, or brisk walking would be a 4 met activity per minute. Right. And so you're like, well, I'll just run faster for a shorter period of time. That is a pivot you can make, very similar to your one set of deadlifts to close to failure. So you could rob Peter to pay Paul in this particular setting. But again, what you run into longer term is that you're going to need more training eventually, and you're going to run out of time to do so if your time is always limited to this to this degree. Also, the fatigue costs can be significant as you get closer and closer to failure, for sure.
Yeah, I think that, you mentioned the 150 minute a week target, but there's also the 75 minute, a week kind of option as far as more vigorous intensity stuff. And so if by, doing the math of somebody trying to target, 75 met minutes, distributing it across 7 days in the week, if they can manage that with a more vigorous activity, be it, daily for a few minutes in a shorter period of time, then you can get there. It may take some creativity. It may be less pleasant, as very high intensity conditioning efforts often tend to be. And you need to be careful with that if it's not something you're ready for or adapted to. But there are, various ways that you could get to that threshold.
Yeah, I could think of somebody who's like, all right, well, look, I really only have 20 minutes per week to do conditioning. So I'm just going to do sprint intensity interval training, right? So no shit, all out sprints. And it's like, well, if you haven't trained that before, I have serious concerns about not only the maybe injury risk potential just due to the high velocities, high grind reactive forces, et cetera, but also just the fatigue costs there. And so I would exercise some caution.
We could build you up to it, but not right off the bat.
Totally. All right. So that's the amount. So we've covered the weight and intensity. So the W, we've covered the amount. That's the volume in our water exercise prescription acronym. So now we're on to type. And so no surprise, we want people to do both resistance training and aerobic training. As far as how to think about resistance training and programming those elements, I break down movement categories into 4 major movement types: a squat pattern, a pressing pattern, pulling pattern, and a hinge pattern. You may use other categorization strategies, but that's what I use. And so this doesn't mean that everybody needs to squat with a barbell, press like bench press or overhead press, pull like pull-ups, or do a hinge like a deadlift. But you should probably be doing some movement that is like that. So a squat type pattern might be a leg press, for example. A press type pattern might be a machine hammer strength press, for example. A pull type pattern might be like a seated row or a dumbbell row or a kettlebell row or a, human row. I guess if you have a spare humans lying around, you could do that. A hinge type pattern might be a hip thrust, an RDL, a stiff legged deadlift, a regular deadlift, a trap bar deadlift. There's machines where you can do this stuff on as well. So that's how I categorize things. And I would want people to be exposed to each one of these movement patterns at least once per week, and at least doing about 3 to 5 sets per week. So you could do those all in one session. You could split up into multiple sessions. We'll talk about that here shortly. But those are the main movement patterns I'd want people to be exposed to at least once per week, again, as sort of our entry level. And then if they can do more than that, great. From an aerobic training standpoint, I would prefer people to do all sorts of different types of conditioning training, whether it's jogging, whether it's running, whether it's cycling, erging on a rower, on a ski erg, swimming even. Although I would say that if people don't have experience swimming, I don't know that that's the highest yield choice because it's relatively fatiguing. The skill component is very, very high. And the problem if you're untrained with swimming is that you can't really do it for very long to get that cardiorespiratory stimulus you want because you're so bad at it. And I don't mean that just to like, you know, talk smack on people who haven't swam before. I swam in high school, but I'm a terrible swimmer now, relatively speaking. It just, if somebody was like, how do I get the biggest bang out of my buck for the 30 minutes for conditioning, exercise bike or swimming? Exercise bike for most folks.
Yeah.
For most folks. You agree as a swimmer?
Totally. On average, you're probably bad at it, and you know you're going to have to be holding your breath for a lot of it, which makes the aerobic component a bit more challenging for a lot of people. And you'll, you know, redline your heart rate probably sooner than you want, especially if you're unfamiliar with the method, the technique, etc. Whereas, you know, you could like imagine doing, you know, laps or intervals on a bike or an erg or something like that, where you were having to hold your breath throughout. It would make it a lot harder. And so until you have that technical aspect down and various other things, it's probably not the best choice for most people.
You also can't really slow down in the pool without, like, you know, drowning potentially or sinking, you know.
Similarly, a technique thing, you know, maintaining your body position is another skill in the water that takes practice and training to be able to do. So I can float very, very, very slowly, but I don't, you know, coaching somebody to be able to do that is actually a challenging endeavor.
Yeah. What do you think the longest swim is you've ever done without any sort of breaks?
You mean like even stopping at the wall necessarily or like in a session?
Like you don't have to do a flip turn on every turn, but you like touch the wall and you're right back at it. Like what's the longest like duration that you've ever like swam for continuously?
I think probably about 10,000 meters.
So what is that in minutes? How long do you think that took you to do?
Oh, I cannot remember. This was like a New Year's Day workout when I was a teenager. Extremely long, couple.
But you compare like my long ride that I did on my bike on Sunday was 2.5 hours, right? Yeah. I just got on the road bike, you know, pounded the pavement or whatever, zone two stuff, not that intense, and I, you know, was fine to squat on Tuesday. Imagine doing a 2.5 hour swim.
Yeah,
like even at your lowest intensity, you would be wrecked.
Yeah.
Not because swimming is like, oh, it's all this force production or whatever. It's just if you're not well acclimated to it.
Yep.
It's tough to do. All right. Enough talking shit on swimming. I'm so sorry. Like, look, swimming is fine. I just think that you have to develop the skills first prior to like using it effectively for conditioning. Okay. So that's the T in our water acronym. And now we're finally on the E and the R for our water-based model of exercise prescription. This stands for effort and regulation. So again, as in all of our programming recommendations, we think that effort is one of the primary considerations, should be one of the primary considerations for programming. We think that the best way to do this is using some auto-regulation like RPE, so ratings of perceived exertion, or repetitions in reserve. Those can be combined together where, for example, if you program somebody to do a set of squats at RP8, that would correlate to 2 repetitions in reserve. So we think for resistance training, most of the compound exercises should be programmed in the RPE 6 to 8 range, so somewhere between 4 to 2 repetitions left in reserve. For isolation or single joint movements like a biceps curl, for example, we think a little bit higher RPE rating, so 7 to 10 would be the recommendation, so 3 repetitions left in reserve or less. And then as far as conditioning, at a relatively low volume of conditioning, I actually don't think it matters much how hard or easy they are, just so long as you do it. Just because, again, if we're thinking about 2 hours a week total, that's just not that much conditioning. But if somebody is limited on time, to your point earlier, oh, I can't do 2.5 hours per week, there's no way I can do that. But 75 minutes per week, I could probably do that. Well, now there's a consideration, like how hard should those things be? Probably in that RP 7 to 8 range or higher as far as the heart rate is concerned. really depends on how you're setting up those efforts. You would think somewhere north of 80% of your max heart rate. We did a whole episode on high intensity interval training, talking about ways to program different intervals and also the differences between high intensity intervals and sprint intensity interval training. I think the problem with most people doing high intensity interval training is that they think it can only be sprints, and that these sprints are done at all out efforts, when the reality is that the best inclusion of high intensity interval training or sprint intensity training is that they're not all out or maximal efforts. They're at a particular pace for a particular purpose, which is similar to strength training. Most of your strength training efforts should not be at all out efforts or maximal efforts. They should be programmed in a way to elicit the desired adaptations. And there you go. And if you're a person who's like, no, I want some nuance here, what sort of intensity distribution and range should I be shooting for? Fine. For 150 minutes per week, if that's what we're talking about 80% of that should be done in the zone two, zone one range. So that's somewhere between 60 to 75-ish% of your max heart rate. So do that for about 120 minutes per week. The other 30 minutes, go nuts. Do whatever you want. High intensity interval training, sprint intensity training. Again, I think it's better when programmed specifically, but I won't, hang somebody out to dry if they just decide to wing it and go crazy. It's 30 minutes per week. You're going to be fine. And then last but not least, probably the central tenet of all of our sort of programming advice is these things should be progressively loaded over time in a way to elicit both health and fitness adaptations, meaning that as you get stronger, as you become more conditioned, as your work capacity improves, et cetera, you're going to have to add weight to make it feel a similar level of difficulty. You're going to have to go faster on your conditioning pieces to make it feel as hard as it once was. And you're going to have to do more work in order to get the same sort of stimulus to drive fitness adaptations. Anything else you want to add to that sort of general exercise prescription discussion?
Yeah, the only thing as it relates to effort and regulation, just recognizing that there may be some folks interested from a time crunch standpoint who are either unfamiliar with the use of metrics or tools like RPE or repetitions in reserve, that there are other ways that you can kind of manage or regulate your effort in the context of whatever program you're using. So as far as the intensity goes, we talked about earlier, for example, for your lifting, aiming for an intensity of greater than, say about 65% of your one rep max, which, you may have a sense of what your one rep max is when you're starting out this period of time crunch. If you don't, and you have to rely on a calculator to get a ballpark figure, that's fine. It's okay. We're compromising a lot of things during time crunch periods, and absolute perfect accuracy on your one rep max and subsequent load selections is not the make or break variable here. So getting a ballpark sense of that, and then your intensity, of the load, you can easily program yourself percentage ranges that you want to hit in the course of your training. So you might say, I want to, work up to a set of, three reps in the range of 80 to 85% or something like that. And then, in the same way that we would use something like RPE or repetitions in reserve to adjust the load based on how we're performing on that day, as you do your warmups and you're like, man, that 80% load was actually harder than I expected it to be, or it was easier than I expected it to be, let me bump it up to the 85%. You can use those ranges to give yourself kind of a target to adjust within. And then based on the intensity that you select, that will determine what rep ranges are even available for you to do, right? So nobody can put 90% of their one rep max on the bar and do a set of 10. That's not possible. If you can do a set of 10, it's not 90%. And so there are various, tables and tools and estimators that can give you like a ballpark figure of that. But ideally, over time, if you pay attention to the effort required to complete a given set, you'll start to get a better kind of calibration of your effort and a sense of like, could I have done another rep there? Absolutely. Okay, then it's no greater than an RPE of 9 or a repetitions or reserve of 1. Could I have done 2 more reps? Maybe. Okay, well then you're probably in the ballpark of an 8, out of 10 effort, for example. So just giving people additional options, using percentage ranges and using rep intensity tables and things like that are all fine tools to use in this situation if you want to get a ballpark of how heavy and how hard to get in the ballpark of what I'm aiming for to at least maintain the adaptations that I've built, or to build some of them if I'm starting out from a less trained spot, or if I want to mitigate losses and potentially even make a bit of progress too.
Yeah, I'd even be willing to say that if you didn't want to use RPE and you didn't want to use percentages, then fine. The effort when you're under the bar or you're on the bike or doing whatever, it needs to be hard enough to make you feel a little uncomfortable, yeah, but not so hard where you feel like I'm in danger of not being able to do one more minute or one more rep or whatever. That's probably too hard. Heavier isn't always better, but it just needs to be hard enough. And that's probably encapsulated by, oh, you feel a little uncomfortable? Good enough. I feel like I feel pretty comfortable saying that, particularly in this application. Speaking of application, all right, well, let's give you guys some tricks here, some tricks and tips and tools of the trade with respect to programming during a time crunch. Again, here, the central paradigm here is to maximize the amount of productive training somebody can do within the amount of time they have available to them. So first thing is establish the time that you actually do have. So is it more conducive to your current schedule and limitations to do longer, fewer sessions? So you have a person who's previously lifting 4 days a week and now they're down to twice per week, but they can do marathon training sessions that are 90 minutes, 120 minutes. That's fine. Or is it more like, man, every day my work schedule is crazy. I can probably get about 30 minutes in per day, but I could do more frequent training sessions. Those would have different approaches. You might have a person who goes from 4 days per week to twice per week in the first versus 4 days per week to 6 days or 7 days per week in the second one. You and I have both experimented with both of these things. And it's mostly personal preference after you get the logistical thing out of the way, because your logistics are kind of supersede your personal preferences in this case. And that also extends to, like, do you do double days where you do like resistance training in the morning and then conditioning later at night? Or do you do double sessions where you just stack them up together and they're marathon sessions where you spend, you know, 2.5 hours total of exercise, but you do those less frequently? Really just depends on your sort of layout here. There's no one that like selection that's better universally than the other. It's more just personal preferences and, again, what your logistical situation is. Next, would recommend laying out the programming to suit those sort of preferences that you've identified based on the amount of time that you have. So generally speaking, when I think about resistance training, I'm thinking about either body part split, so like a chest day or chest and back day, something like that, or like bench and deadlift. You could do those movements, for example. You could do body part or you could do full body. And generally speaking, I think about body part splits taking less time than full body training sessions. Most of that is due to warm-up time tending to be decreased and also potentially like setup time, right? You could think about, oh, I'm doing chest today, for example, or it's a pressing focus day. Okay, so you did bench press, now you're gonna do overhead press, and then you're gonna do, you know, some sort of dumbbell press. It's like, well, shoot, what did you need? You needed a bench that was set up, you got a barbell there, boom, and you got some dumbbells after that. Like, you didn't have to set up a squat station, an overhead press station, and then like a deadlift station. Mostly personal preference, but again, logistics kind of supersede that. So that's how I think about resistance training. Generally, when I'm laying out a program, I want to put the higher priority movement first. So those tend to be compound movements that are loaded the heaviest, that you care about the most. So for me, as a recovering power lifter, I tend to put squat, bench, and deadlift variations first. In a week where I'm training 4 times, 5 times, 6 times, if I'm doing more sessions, more frequent, a higher frequency of sessions, I would tend to alternate doing an upper body movement first and then a lower body movement second. So I wouldn't just have like squats first every single time, even if I was doing, you know, 1 or 2 movements per day. I would pick squats first on one day, bench first on the next day, deadlifts first on the next day, something like that. Does that kind of jive with your experience?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in my historical setups, I've either had access, like in my garage, I might have been able to have 2 racks during certain periods of my life, or other times when I just had one, but it was like one of the deeper racks. And in that situation, I'd be able to set up 2 movements on the same thing. So maybe bench out of the front and squat out of the back, or overhead press out of the front and deadlift on the platform in front of it or something like that. And alternating those movements, like you mentioned, upper and lower body, even within a session, not even necessarily across sessions, is an extremely useful tool, because you effectively, you know, given that I do not generally take many of my sets, if any, to failure, it means that I can, you know, move between them with relatively short rest periods, alternating between the two. And so you can get a really good, you know, effectively a full body stimulus on 2 exercises going between them when you have that type of a setup.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Another thing to consider is like the, it goes back to the setup time. So if I'm doing like a full body or programming a full body session, I want to make sure that the, like setting up the exercise station isn't too onerous for somebody who's limited on time. So I'll frequently pair things like squat and press together, overhead press, because the bar's at the same height, it's in the rack already. All you got to do is change the load. Or same thing, if I know that in somebody's program, they're going to do a deadlift movement from the, you know, and they're going to do some sort of rowing movement with the barbell. I'm like, cool, let's stack those together. The bar's already out. It's already set up. All you got to do is change the load. Or if somebody's going to be doing some work in a squat rack, period, I'm going to try to put all of that together so they don't have to go inside the rack, out of the rack, setting up stuff all over the place. Again, we're just trying to limit setup time, which does seem to reduce the total amount of time spent training if it's necessary. So that's the resistance training portion when you think about laying out the program, broadly speaking. I like to determine, all right, here's how many sets that I want to do. Here's the types of exercises that I want to use, and then put down, put pen to paper and kind of lay it out a little bit more explicitly. For aerobic training, for conditioning, it's pretty much free for all here. You can do this after resistance training. You can do it on separate days. You can also break up the conditioning training. If it's a 30-minute piece, for example, you could do it in 5-minute chunks if you want. Probably best done under prolonged efforts. But again, we're sort of compromising things here due to the time crunch, and that's okay too. All right. So we move on to some more tricks here. So the first thing you had here was modifying warmups. How do you go about doing that? People are like, well, warmups are set in stone. How do you modify them to take less time?
Yeah, I think that this is something that, depending on your habitual mentality towards warm-ups, some people, you know, either enjoy, maybe it's a meditative or ritual to spend a ton of time doing a whole lot of, you know, warm-up type movements, non-specific warm-ups, you know, mobility, stretching, all sorts of other things that people might get in the habit of. I mean, I think that you would agree that that's the kind of stuff that, unless it is at like necessary for you to even be able to like access a particular range of motion, that is usually the first stuff that's going to go in this type of situation, because it is unlikely to be adding to your fitness when you do it. And it is probably not doing a ton to reduce the risks of participating in, you know, exercise in terms of like injury risk and things like that. So we tend to jettison that stuff pretty quickly, do more, you know, task specific warmups, dynamic warmups, alternating between the movements with the empty bar, for example. I'll sometimes have people do things like, you know, squat the empty bar for a set of three, and you just do sets of three like every 20 to 30 seconds. And then after a minute or two, then they're, you know, warmed up and ready to start adding some load. And so that's one aspect of it. And then the other is, it is possible, depending on how strong someone is, to get comfortable over time taking slightly bigger jumps than you would otherwise. That's something that does, you know, take a little bit of confidence and some boldness that can be built up to over time. You know, I remember we often joke about you tend to take some of the biggest warm-up jumps that I've ever heard of. I have grown into taking some big jumps, but you know, going the first time you make a big plate jump from 405 to 495, or the first time we went from 220 kilos to 270 kilos, or, you know, whatever, those big jumps are the kind of things that, you know, you would want some experience with before you jumped into something like that in a time crunch type scenario. But when I look at the times when I've been restricted on time and tried to, you know, squeeze something in, if say I'm working up to a top single rep effort, and I have a ballpark sense of where I'm going to end up, because I'm, you know, based on confidence and experience and how I'm generally feeling that day, then, you know, it is comfortable and reasonable for me to, you know, eliminate, I don't know why my brain broke there for a second, or skip certain weights that I would have otherwise normally taken, right? And then if you're not, you know, pulling 300 kilos off the floor, but maybe you're instead going to be working up to something in the, you know, 300 pound range on a squat or something like that, you can probably skip the 185 pound warmup. You know, you might be able to go, you know, from 95 to 135 to, you know, 225 or something like that. It might be a little intimidating at first, but it might save you a little bit of time in this process as well. So experimenting to see what you're comfortable with and the kind of jumps that you can reasonably take is another way to do this. Eliminating the fluff, moving a little bit quicker, shorter rest periods, doing fewer reps on the warm-ups as well, so that you need less time to recover after each warm-up set, and then taking slightly bigger jumps are all ways to condense that warm-up time period down.
Yeah. Yeah. Generally speaking, when I'm doing warm-ups, I'm loading the bar and going, and that's why sometimes I'll do less reps per set, and then I'm taking a big rest between my last warm-up and my first working set, if it's going to be heavy. And yeah, the most I've done, the biggest jump I think I've ever made is 110 kilos. I went from 220 to, oh no, it was 60 kilos. Yeah. 220 to 280 is what I've done before. Okay. I think is my biggest on squats, which was, I think on deadlifts, I've gone more than that, maybe like 80 or 90 kilos. Anyway, another thing that people will probably be familiar with are supersets. So doing one exercise and then another exercise directly after with minimal or no rest in between. Now, there are three real like categories of ways to do supersets. One is agonist-agonist. That'd be like doing a bench press and then dumbbell bench press. You're doing the same muscle groups back to back. Generally don't recommend that because what it does is it limits the amount of volume that people can do at a given level of effort. And so it's basically just reduced training is what you see there. People are like, oh, I got a sick pump. I'm like, well, the pump is cool, but the actual efficacy of doing reduced volume, particularly over a long period of time, is not exactly what you'd want. It just feels harder, more fatigue, et cetera. Agonist and antagonist supersets, so doing something like a bench press followed by a seated row, on the other hand, that doesn't actually seem to reduce the amount of training volume that people can do at all. So that can be a pretty useful situation if people can set up those two stations and go back and forth between them. So the way that I do that currently is I'll do something like my bench press set, and then I'll go over and I'll do the rowing exercise that I've had to do, and then I'll rest 2 or 3 minutes in between sets, and my performance has been about the same and less time taken overall because I'm simultaneously doing two exercises. And the third setup, which is probably the one that you've used the most, is sort of this alternate peripheral, which is a dumb name, terrible name.
Yeah,
doesn't
agree.
Mean anything. But it'd be like doing a squat and then an overhead press, for example, or squat and then a bench press, or deadlift and chin-ups. It's like, okay, not the same muscle groups at all, unrelated, different movement patterns, but still two different exercises that you could do back to back.
Yeah, that's for sure my preferred. And I even do that with accessory type work as well, even in my routine training, because I find that less interesting in general. So I'll do some, I don't know, lat pull down or a seated cable row, and then alternate that with like a leg extension or something like that. So either way, yeah, I like alternating separate body parts, and you can move through those relatively quickly and get a good stimulus.
Yep. General heuristic here, though, is as long as it doesn't limit the amount of work that you can do, it is going to be good for this sort of application. So agonist-agonist, probably not favored here, but agonist-antagonist, good. Alternate peripheral, also good. You can use either of those. And so I'll just do two of the sets back-to-back, rest 2 or 3 minutes in between, and do the whole thing again. Speaking of rest periods, I would almost just vehemently recommend 2 to 3 minutes per set tops. Longer than that, sure, could be useful for like maximum strength performance, particularly that day. But I'm not sure that people gain more strength over time. The evidence is not necessarily clear on that in untrained or in untrained individuals. Shorter than 2 minute rest periods, though, almost universally worse for hypertrophy and strength. If you're doing 90 seconds or 60 seconds, that's the only way you can exercise. That's certainly better than no exercise. But the problem is the shorter rest periods really do tend to compromise the amount of training volume that people can do. And if that is the case, you're effectively reducing the amount of fitness adaptations you can get from workout. So generally would not recommend going shorter than 2 minutes. Simultaneously, generally would not recommend going longer than 3 minutes in a time crunch setting because you're going to run out of time to train. And so again, if it limits the amount of training you can do, probably not worth the short-term benefit, generally speaking. One interesting way I found to program this is by using this sort of EMOM setup, EMOM being an acronym that stands for every minute on the minute. People are probably familiar with this if they have an Olympic lifting background or CrossFit background where you would do, you know, a handful of reps every minute on the minute. I don't really use that much for general strength and conditioning, particularly for folks who are interested in strength and hypertrophy, but every 2 minutes on the minute or every 3 minutes on the minute is something that I've used and am currently using in my current program. So I'll do a top set, right? I'll warm up to my normal top set of somewhere between 3 to 6 reps at RP 6 to 8. And then I'll do back off sets every 2 or 3 minutes on the minute until it gets to a certain level of difficulty. In my case, anything that's heavier about RP or higher effort than RP 8, I'm like, oh, that's enough for the day. And so I'm encapsulating my variance and performance with that sort of setup. So if I'm feeling particularly awesome, I can maybe do 3 or 4 back off sets. But if on a day where I'm not really feeling it, it's going to be 1 or 2 back off sets. And the way I decide between every 2 minutes on the minute versus every 3 minutes on the minute, the more important the movement is, the more rest I'm going to take for it. So like a squat, bench, deadlift, or other heavy compound exercise, I'm doing every 3 minutes on the minute. It's just my general preference. But for a machine-based exercise, an isolation-based exercise, or something of lower priority, I'm doing every 2 minutes on the minute. So I could do like a lat pull down, do a top set of 10 reps at RP 8, and then every 2 minutes on the minute, do the same weight for 8 reps until it feels harder than RP 8 every 2 minutes on the minute. And so if I can get three back offsets, great. If it's more back offsets, great. If it's fewer, I'm not feeling it that day, but I still got some useful work in. I can move on. The last thing I'll say with respect to rest periods is that you, or time in general, is use the use of time caps. I've used this also both professionally and personally, where I'll say, look, you got 20 minutes to do your squats for today. Then you've got 15 minutes to do the secondary movement, whatever that is. Could be another lower body exercise, could be another upper body, or a different upper body exercise, if they're doing a full body split, whatever. And then for a isolation exercise or otherwise lesser exercise of lesser importance, you got 10 minutes to do all the warm-ups, all the back offsets, start your timer. There you go. It's a useful way also to sort of regulate training. On days that you feel awesome, you'll be able to do more in that given time period. And on days you don't feel so good, well, you're sort of capped. You can't just extend the session on indefinitely to get all the work in, which may be too much stress for how you're currently feeling on that day. You ever use time caps, Austin?
I've used them sometimes professionally with people who I wanted to get them maybe an additional exposure for technical proficiency, for confidence, something like that. They'll have a session where I'll say, hey, like, set a timer for 8 minutes and work up to a top set of 1 to 3 reps on the bench. No back offsets, just to like get another exposure in during the week. But yeah, I see how you use those here. And another, you know, comment to your point, say you did 20 minutes for your squat work and the person has to kind of like learn how to, even though it's not an endurance activity, they have to learn how to like pace their squat session to get through whatever they might want during that period of time. And then say you get to like your isolation, say you get through your squat, you know, 20 minute, 15 minute, and then like at the end, maybe it's just like, okay. And then, you know, you get one set of pull-ups, as many as possible to failure, like bang out as many reps as you possibly can. And maybe if they're like a motivated trainee who like wants to squeeze in everything they can in a session, that they'll push something like that relatively hard, which for accessory type work is completely fine to push that stuff a little closer to failure. That's another way to get some added stimulus in.
Yep. Again, central paradigm here is trying to do the most amount of work that you can, as long as it's loaded intelligently, taken to a reasonable proximity to failure, the exercise selection is correct. That's pretty much the name of the game here. Last thing I want to mention here before we wrap this up is rest days, because people will invariably say, well, look, if I'm training 7 days a week, you know, just these little 20-minute sessions, I have no rest days. I'm like, so?
Yeah.
Similarly, if someone's like, oh, I can only train twice per week, when should my rest days be? I'm like, it doesn't matter. And that's really how I feel about rest days. Both the evidence kind of supports this, and then also my personal experience supports this. I will say that, yes, if I'm favoring top-level performance, peak, you know, peak-level adaptations and such, I would probably change my tune on this, where I really am considering, you know, when's the last time you squatted versus your most important deadlift day? When's the last time you bench pressed compared to like repeating your most important bench workout? Sure. But in situations like this where time is limited, I think having a flexible schedule where you can either train back days back to back or back to back to back, or training every day, you know, multiple days in a row, that's all fine. And in fact, when you look at the evidence on this, it doesn't seem to matter that much. This one particular study took 30 recreationally active men and had them do the same 3-day-a-week program of leg press, lat pull downs, leg curls, shoulder press, and leg extensions. One group trained 3 days in a row every week, and the other group trained on non-consecutive days, so Monday, Wednesday, Friday. After 12 weeks, both groups got much stronger, adding an average of 50 kilos to their 10-rep max leg press. But there were no differences in strength gained between groups. They both did the same. They also both gained a lot of muscle mass, but again, there was no difference between groups. So not really highlighting this sort of idea where you have to be fresh for every session, or you have to be well rested for every session. Again, we're looking at getting the most amount of work done in an appropriately programmed exercise intervention over a relatively long period of time. It's probably not just a week, probably not just 2 weeks, probably not just 1 month, but we're thinking about maybe the most amount of work you can get done in a 2-month period, in a 3-month period, something like that, as long as, again, the elements of the program are reasonable. And just speaking lastly to this, having flexibility, you don't have to do the same workout on the same days every week. That I would prefer that personally, just for my own sort of OCD and tendencies, yeah, and whatever. But that's if I'm unopposed by a sort of time cap. Having some flexibility here can be very, very useful.
Yeah, I've had situations where obviously my schedule was way less predictable. And I thought about this at the outset when you recommended that folks like establish the amount of time that they have available to train per week. And I'm like, well, I can think of periods of time where I was like, if you ask me that, I'd say, I don't know. Sometimes, you know, people try to die at the end of my shift and I have to stay a little longer than I thought. And other days I get out a little earlier than I thought. And it all kind of comes out in the wash in the end, but I can't know it in advance. And so that's a situation where I might have a goal, you know, amount of work that I would like to get done across the week. And my goal is to get that done however I can. And so that allows me to kind of adjust and call an audible on a given day where it's like, oh, this was a day where I didn't have the time that I expected. Maybe I'll just get the first exercise in, and then the second and third, if I had three, say, are going to get relegated to a different day. And then if I have a day where things are a little bit longer, I'm like, oh, let me take advantage of this a little bit more and see if I can squeeze in a little bit more of the programmed work. So in the same way that you set like a time cap and it's like people should adapt to fit what the goal work is in that time cap, this is like extending it and saying like, well, your time cap is a week to get this done. Get it done however you can based on the unpredictability of your schedule, which is another way to offer some flexibility for people who are not able to predetermine certain things here.
Yeah. And there's some obvious flexibility where people can, you know, extend their week, quote unquote, to a 9-day week or a 10-day
totally.
Week. It starts getting a little messy when it comes to schedule. Yeah, weeks are made up. It starts getting a little messy when people are like, look, man, I got to the end of the month and I had 6 sessions that I missed, or, you know, 6 elements of my program that I missed. And it's like, well, we may have been overzealous in programming this based on your current schedule. So maybe we need to adjust that, or we need to figure out a way where it's taking you less time to do the other stuff you already did so you can get the rest of these things in. But again, I'm thinking work done over a 2-month, 3-month period. That's really the sort of like the reckoning period of time is what I'm thinking of. It doesn't really matter week to week, but over a month, 2 months, 3 months, that's, I think it starts to become far more important.
Yeah, not unlike, you know, this is completely, you know, separate from the topic of this podcast, but when you've talked about energy balance and weight outcomes and things like that, like you're hitting an exact calorie deficit, like, you know, hour to hour or day to day matters less compared with over much longer periods of time. So your cumulative exposure to, you know, exercise training is gonna drive your outcomes. So the better we can distribute that for your situation, the better.
Yep. All right. Well, that is a wrap here on episode 325, How to Train When Time is Limited. First, we want you to do anything. Next, we want you to meet or exceed the current physical activity guidelines, and everything else on top of that is playing with house money. Just depends how fit you are, your goals, and how much time you have to play with. But we want you to do the most amount of training that you can, as long as it's intelligently programmed, over time. That's the name of the game here. Thank you so much for listening to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Again, I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Shout out to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining us on this week's podcast. And before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, we'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine, and over the last 10-plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite-level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help.